This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast on iTunes or your smartphone. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone and search for DC 37 State of the Union. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Check out our website, www.dc37.net. And if you have any comments about our show, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. This show, the theme of this show is Books Matter, and what's in them matters. And we're going to be talking to two authors tonight. The first is Eric Loomis. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Rhode Island. His book is called A History of America in 10 Strikes. Right. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It is our pleasure. Tell us what this book is about. 10 Strikes.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I thought, you know, so often in when we teach American history or think about American history, the story of labor is left out, or it's a footnote. And I thought, you know, especially in the aftermath of the 2016 election and all of the complexity around that, you know, I thought it would be very useful to rethink American history if we put labor at the center of it. What would the story look like if we focused on labor, if we focused on the rise of the middle class, if we focused on the struggles to create that middle class, the struggles that workers had over the centuries to do that, and then the decline of that in the last 40 years? What if we looked at how race and class intersected? What if we looked at how gender and class intersected, or politics and class? And by putting class at the center of American history, I think that we refocus this history back to, you know, really the majority of Americans. We tell a story that touches something that all Americans share, the experience of work, whether that's paid work in a factory, whether it's as a janitor, or whether it's unpaid work in the home. Labor is something that all humans are united around. And the lack of that labor, if we are unemployed, that's also a major thing in American history. That's also something that, because of the way our society is structured, can be shameful even. And so by refocusing our history on class, I hope to tell a different side of American history and really focus on those moments of struggle that really define what America means to so many people.
Well, the first question I always like to ask an author is, how long did it take you to write this book? tell us about the process of writing the book.
Yeah, you know, writing a book is hard. I actually originally started working on this back in 2015, before the election. And you know, it was, I thought I had written a couple of books before this, and I thought, you know, this is a pretty good idea. I'm excited to write it, and it'll actually be, you know, not that hard. But boy, was I wrong. It was actually very hard to write this book. I mean, you know, first of all, you have to choose which strikes to focus on, and there's so many that you could focus on. And each one you have to justify and think about, you know, is this really the strike that highlights an era or a point that needs to be made? And then when 2016 happened, and you know, for all of its terribleness, you know, that made me refocus the entire book, too, and think about this book as a way to help resistance to the rise of fascism, a way to understand the relationship between social movements and the government, a way to understand the connections between race and class that's so often, and, you know, so much of the debate over 2016 was it about the Democrats abandoning the working class? Was it about racism? And I thought, you know, really it's about both. And we need to not think in terms of there's only one reason why Donald Trump happened. There are many reasons, but trying to sort of rewrite the book to make it work on, make it look at that. So yeah, it was actually, that's a really interesting question. It was a much harder process than I thought it would be. But I hope in the end that people think it was a worthy cause for me.
One of the pieces of conventional wisdom is that the decline of the middle class and the decline of the decline of the middle class is connected to the decline of unions, and the decline of unions in modern times is so connected to the air traffic controller strike of 1981. What are your thoughts about the importance of that strike, and what are your conclusions, if any, about the impact that strike had on the modern day labor movement?
Sure, that's an outstanding question. I mean, I think that I guess I have two things to say about that. Yes, I think it's absolutely one of the most important strikes in American history, easily the greatest disaster in the history of American labor. And it was probably a bad idea. The air traffic controllers, you know, I mean, they made a lot of errors, including not consulting with other unions. I mean, they weren't really acting in solidarity with other unions. You know, that caused a lot of anger within the labor movement, something that I focus on in the book itself, in the chapter. Chapter 9 is the chapter that focuses on that. But I also think that the decline of the middle class, the decline of unions, was already in the cards. I mean, part of the reason there was so much, the air traffic controllers had so little support, was that, through the 70s, the already existing decline of unions, especially the private sector, and the move from an industrial economy to a financial economy that really didn't have a role for workers, something that certainly we see today, and all of these big structural things were already happening. And so when the air traffic, when Reagan fires the controllers, you know, there are tens of thousands of people who apply for those jobs, even at a lower salary, because already there was mass, you know, a decline of the working class. So, you know, say the steel industry had lost tens of thousands of jobs in the 70s. The timber industry, which is an industry that I focus on in my academic work, had lost tens of thousands of jobs. Auto had lost tens of thousands of jobs. And so, you know, I think that the air traffic controller strike and Reagan firing them was a symbol, a sign, and a message to private employers that now you could just get rid of your unions entirely. And that happened through the 80s. And I focus on some of those issues as well. But I think that the cards were already on the table, and that the air traffic controllers strike was the joker that set the whole house on fire, if I can mix my metaphors there.
And you just did.
Yes.
but the strikes go, the strikes that you cover, and obviously you're talking about dramatic actions in the most dramatic action that a union can take is to go on strike. And so you're looking at these going back to the 1830s, I believe, the Lowell Mill Girls Strike. But I'm interested in reading about what's been written about your book. There is another take on slavery and Lincoln and the Civil War that I'd like you to talk a little bit about. And I've just poorly condensed that, so the listener has no idea what I'm talking about. So take a couple of minutes to explain what I am talking about.
You bet. So, you know, when we think about labor actions, sometimes they happen in union, and that maybe is the ideal way that they happen. But oftentimes, you know, a lot of workers don't have unions, and they take actions of their own. And honestly, that includes slaves. You know, when we think about slavery in this country, we often forget, you know, we talk about racism, and obviously it was a horribly racist system and all that, but the reason it existed was a labor system, right? This is the ideal labor system for a large part of the United States, and frankly, you know, much of European colonization of the entire America was based on slavery of Native Americans and then of Africans. And so, you had 4 million slave workers in the South in 1861, when Southern states commit treason in defense of slavery. And, you know, these slave owners really believed that their slave workers were actually happy, that they were loyal. I mean, they were high on their own supply, basically, in thinking about their workers. And what happened is that these slaves, as soon as they can, anytime union lines, the Union Army gets close to them, they flee to those union lines.
Right.
And all of a sudden, the Northern Army has to think, what do we do with these people? And very quickly, they realize, wow, you know, if we accept these people in our lines, this takes away the Southern labor force. That the South will no longer be able to grow that cotton, produce those goods that they need for their military. And so, you know, all the way back in the 1930s, the great African-American scholar W.E.B. Du Bois recognizes this action beginning in 1861, and by 1864, it's thousands and thousands and thousands of slaves fleeing as a general strike. And he's right about that. This is a general strike of slaves simply stopping to work and walking away anytime they can. And this actually is what forces Lincoln to take slavery seriously as a cause of the war and issue the Emancipation Proclamation in 1862. Lincoln does a brave thing in 1862 by doing that, but it was slaves that forced his hand, and it was slaves that played a huge role in the North winning the Civil War by walking off their jobs.
That's a hugely important observation to make based on the American narrative now about the Civil War has to do with emancipation. But you're saying that the slaves took a huge role in their own destiny with the actions that they took by abandoning slave labor, right?
Yes, absolutely. And really, you know, after the war as well, they, you know, these freed slaves have their own agenda. I mean, they have very specific things that they want that they envision as their American dream. You know, they want land and they don't want to work for white people. Unfortunately, that did not fit either Southern whites or Northern whites' vision. And so in the years after the war, you know, these ex-slaves now are also fighting for their own freedom. They're engaging in continued labor actions. And unfortunately, you know, they're not really granted that. And both Northern and Southern whites come and oppress that agenda and basically force them into sharecropping and Jim Crow America and all of this. And so, you know, in many ways, the black freedom struggle and things like today, like the Fight for 15, you know, which is a largely African-American movement in many places, you know, it's really part of a long, long agenda for black economic emancipation that goes back to the period of slavery.
We've just got about a minute and a half left. Just want to get your take on where do you think the labor movement stands now?
Well, look, I mean, obviously the labor movement is in trouble. I mean, I think that one point I make in the book is that it's very difficult and almost impossible for unions to really succeed if business and the government are united against them. And many of the strikes I talk about really, I think, elucidate this connection between government and business. And we return to an era today where, like in the, you know, 1890s and 1900s, government is aligned openly with business against unions. Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, these are people who are, you know, anti-union hacks, basically, who are going to rule against unions just because they don't like unions.
Right.
And it's grim, but the thing is that workers will always continue to fight. That the labor movement itself may be in trouble, but no matter what happens, workers will always fight for what they think is right, and the story of labor will never end. Even if unions are busted and we enter into some dark days ahead, people will continue to fight for what's right.
Brother, I love your smarts, and I love your energy. Eric Loomis is Associate Professor of History at the University of Rhode Island. His book is called A History of America in 10 Strikes. Is there anywhere that folks can get this book, or is there a website, or is there anything that you want to tell people on how to get to you?
You can get the book at any of your online websites that you prefer to buy from. Many of your local bookstores are going to have them as well. And obviously, if you can patronize a local bookstore, that's awesome. But you can also order it online at any online server.
Thanks very much for joining us. We'll be right back.
Thank you for having me.
You a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. ¶¶
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. Please, any comments you have about this show, you want to drop us a line, it's stateoftheunion@dc37.net. We're talking books this evening, and our next guest is Ron Howell. He is a former Newsday reporter, Daily News reporter, Baltimore Sun reporter. He's now a professor of journalism at Brooklyn College, and he is the author of a book called Boss of Black Brooklyn, The Life and Times of Bertram L. Baker. And welcome to the show, Ron Howell.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's a pleasure and an honor to be with you.
Let's talk about Bertram Baker. Many of our listeners don't know who Bertram Baker is. There are political figures in this city who, historical figures, who people don't know as well as they should, and you have written a book about one of them. Talk about Bertram Baker.
Yes, well, the truth is that it may seem kind of ridiculous, but I think there are a number of elected officials and perhaps black elected officials who didn't know the name Bertram Baker. I think that slowly they're coming to know who he was, because he was important in the history of New York City, and very specifically the history of politics in Brooklyn. He was the first black elected official in Brooklyn, and he himself always pointed out that he was the first black elected official, as opposed to what everyone says, the first black assemblyman elected from Brooklyn. For some reason or other, even after you say who he was and his significance, the thing that keeps getting repeated is that he was the first black assemblyman. And in fact, he was, but he was also the first black elected official in the history of not just Brooklyn as part of the city, which came to be in 1898, but in all of Brooklyn, going back to the origins of Kings County, you know, which goes back really to the you know, end of the Revolutionary War. He was the first black who was elected to office, and that's his significance really in terms of history. There, you know, other parts of him too that are significant for different reasons, but I thought it was time to let people know who he was. And oh, I should add, by the way, and
yeah,
I hope
go
it
ahead.
Doesn't puzzle you, that he was my grandpa.
Yes, I know.
Sometimes this comes up, like, or sometimes I even forget to mention it, because I mean, I do consider it a biography, and I just have to tag that on at the end. Oh, by the way,
right, exactly. I was wondering how you were going to sort of throw that in, but let's talk about this, because I mean, it is kind of amazing that it's always amazing to me how young we are, you know, and I feel that way whenever I see something written about anything in Europe. You know, you're going back, you know, Africa, you're going back thousands of years, hundreds, thousands of years. So what you're saying is that in 1948, the first person ever elected to represent Brooklyn, the first black person ever elected to represent Brooklyn, 1948, that's 60 years ago. I mean, that's it is amazing to me how young. Before he got there, what had he done to get elected? And what were black people doing politically in 1948?
Yes. One very important fact about him is that he was born in the Caribbean, that, and in fact, on a the tiniest of places, I like to say, called Nevis, which is what I think 24 miles circumference.
Right.
You know, such a small place, and he was born there in 1898. In other words, he was elected. He was into his middle age when he was elected. You know, he was
must be like 50 years old.
That's right. He was 50 years old when he was elected. So it's not like he was you know, 30 and starting out. He had been around, you know, he had been around the block. And he was born in 1898, which is poetic in a way, because that was, in fact, the year that Brooklyn became part of New York City. You know, the consolidation of the five boroughs into New York City. It was almost like something whispering, you know, from north of where he was here in New York that, hey, you know, baby, you know, you're gonna be a player right here one day. And then he heard it, and, you know. And in fact, he was that kind of...
When did he come here?
In 1915.
And he came here
He was 17 years old.
And then when does he get to politics? And how... I want to focus on how did he get to politics and how did politics shape the life of the community that he was representing?
He got into politics because he always says that he wanted to be an Episcopal priest first. You know, back in Nevis, it was Anglican, of course, Church of England, but he came here and they call it the Episcopal Church. And then he found that it was just going to be too hard for a black person. And he said he looked around and he saw that things were difficult for blacks here and that they needed to get involved in politics. And so he decided that pretty quickly. I would say by the early 1920s, there wasn't much he could do until he became a citizen, which was 1924. But right away, he got wrapped up in politics. And then as now, it means going to your local club and saying, hey, I want to be involved. You know, you don't come out and say, I want to be elected to the assembly, because they'll look at you and, you know, probably won't have anything to do with you because they'll see you as competition. But he wanted to work the streets. You know, which meant going around, especially around election time, with petitions and saying, I can get signatures. And the value of someone like that, you know, who you do it right, you get to be a captain, you know, in your club, you know, and you're in charge of some blocks. And they rely on you to get people to sign the petitions, you know, allowing someone to qualify as a Democratic candidate, which is really, really important. And at the time, what made it especially important was that he was working as a Democrat when so many black people were Republicans, you know? I mean, we talk about history and going back in time.
That's right. Of course. Of course.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we think that in the 1900s, oh, you know, black people are Democrats. No. No, when he came, that was not the case. There were a lot of black folks, probably at that point most, who were Republicans, and he was dealing with that. You know, one advantage he might have had was that, you know, being a West Indian, you know, you come and you just sort of see what's going on and you say, hey, you know, I want to get a job, you know, a patronage job. I need to go to the Democrats. And you're not necessarily thinking that, you know, the people you're dealing with who were the Irish politicians, oh, you know, they were involved in the draft riots and they were killing us, you know, and in 1863, the draft riots, remember, in you remember as if you were there, right?
Yeah, right.
a lot of the Irish Democrats, you know, would have been involved, their people involved in the riots, beating up black people, you know. But
we have to remind listeners that you know, the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln and the emancipation of the slaves, and the that's a different mindset than where we are today in 2018. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
no, you're absolutely right. Sometimes you make assumptions, but you know, we're looking in the 1920s and you know, they're much closer in time to the 1860s and the Civil War. I mean, there were people alive, you know, who were in the Civil War, you know.
Right, right.
Back then. So it meant, you know, a lot. The other thing was that, you know, you have to keep in mind just what New York and Brooklyn was at the time. You know, it was a place, you know, pretty much run by Irish Democrats. The Democrats were growing in power in Brooklyn, you know, especially as the Irish were replacing some of the, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants and descendants of the original Dutch folks who were living, you know, who had lived in the original, built the brownstones and were living in them. The Irish came in and started, you know, replacing them. And they became the dominant group in the borough, and in the city, you know, Lower Manhattan too. And Baker right away realized that and said, "I got to find a way of dealing with them." So that's what happened when he went to his club on Gates Avenue in Brooklyn,
Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Yeah, and the term wasn't even in use then, Bedford-Stuyvesant. It was just the Bedford neighborhood. There was a section on the other end called Stuyvesant, of course, and it, you know, but black people were growing in numbers in the 1920s. World War One saw the beginnings of the Great Migration, and some blacks like him coming up from the Caribbean. The numbers were relatively small, small.
So let's jump forward to what was his accomplishment as a legislator? What was his most significant accomplishment, in your opinion? And we've only got a couple of minutes. I hate to do this, but...
Yes, I understand. He would say, and has said all the time, that it was the Metcalf-Baker bill from 1956. Metcalf being the senator who sponsored the bill in the Senate, 1956, George Metcalf, who was a Republican, by the way, in the 1950s, when things started to get closer to
so
are now.
That was bipartisan legislation that accomplished what?
That, and it was the first law in the nation that outlawed discrimination in the sale or rental, racial discrimination in the sale or rental of housing. So he thought it was so significant. The thing is, we look back on it from our advantage, time advantage. You say, well, you know, what good did it do when you look around? And that's true. You know, the significance in some ways was symbolic, but people were very wrapped up in it and thought at the time that that much would happen because, you know, serious politics is about hope.
And it made housing discrimination illegal, right? I mean, this act...
That's right, and it made... Well, and you have to qualify it. Housing discrimination over which the state could have some control, which meant housing that had some public funding, you know.
Right.
So in some ways it was symbolic, but it did... He did push to get it stronger every year. So it was rewritten from that time up through the 60s to make it stronger.
And everything about politics, so much about politics and about the life of politics is about jobs. And he also secured jobs for many folks through his position, right? And the book is called Boss of Black Brooklyn. The author is Ron Howell. Ron Howell is a journalism professor at Brooklyn College and a distinguished journalist who has worked at the Baltimore Sun, the Daily News, and Newsday. I'm running out of time. I've got about 45 seconds left. And the nut line on this book, in your opinion, sir?
Oh, that life is about fidelity to one's inner desires and to one's family. And I say that because Bertram Baker meant a lot for Black Brooklyn, but he meant a lot also to the families who lived in Bed-Stuy, and I know that because I was with a group of them 2 days ago who were members of the Little League that he started in the 1950s. And those ball players now in their 70s were there, and they thanked him for the difference that he made in their lives.
Thank you very much, Ron. I'm sorry we're running out of time, and that's all we have for the evening. Till next time, folks. Ciao.